ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife. News breakdown.
Well, it's not exactly Jaucus, as some are calling it, but Australia and its AUKUS partners, the US and the UK, where we get the AUKUS from, are considering including Japan to some extent in part of its alliance. The defence ministers of the three countries released a statement saying they're considering working with Japan on so-called Pillar 2 of the agreement, with the focus on technology development. Australia's Defence Industry Minister Pat Conroy, who's in Washington for the talk, says the countries have been clear from the start that they're open to working with other nations.
This is collaborating on technology development under AUKUS Pillar 2 on a project-by-project basis. It's not about Japan joining AUKUS. It's not about Japan being part of the Five Eyes intelligence community. It's about technological collaboration where it makes sense for all parties involved.
Well, the Prime Minister was on it as well, also emphasising the point that it's not an expansion of the nuclear-powered submarine pact.
When we look at Pillar 2, that project-by-project approach is there. What is not proposed is to expand the membership of AUKUS.
Well, the coalition is keen on the idea. Opposition leader Peter Dutton says it'd be a great outcome if Japan could be a part of advanced military capability projects through the AUKUS Security Pact. And he says Japan is an incredibly important ally.
Our job is to join up with like-minded partners to make sure that we can keep peace in our region and to make sure that our relationship with China grows. But nonetheless, there are sovereign issues that we need to deal with, and we need to stand up for our values and what we believe in and do that with like-minded partners like Japan.
Well, watching these matters closely is Andrew Tillett. Andrew's Defence and Foreign Affairs reporter with the Australian Financial Review, who's also now reporting that Canada might join AUKUS as well. And Andrew joins us for the news breakdown. Andrew, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks, Phil. Nice to be here.
Well, not Jaucus. Maybe caucus could be confusing with an ALP government in power. Now, what's the situation here? I mean, Japan would be sharing some tasks and information, but Canada might be talking submarines. I thought, and as I'm sure most people did, that AUKUS was principally about Australia acquiring nuclear submarine capacity and capability from initially the US and then subsequently the UK. How did it happen that it's all of, that it's Japan and Canada involved?
Well, it's always sort of been, obviously, that they call them the two pillars of AUKUS. And pillar one is pretty straightforward, although wildly expensive, the nuclear-powered submarines. You know, and that was something that the Morrison government drove about trying to get it going. But pillar two is sort of basically other sort of advanced military technology that's sort of in its infancy, things like hypersonic missiles or quantum computing, artificial intelligence, undersea drones, electronic warfare. And that's always been part of it. It hasn't sort of been attracted the headlines. But in its own way, it's sort of been an important part because that's the sort of technology that we can sort of get sooner than nuclear-powered submarines.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Pillar 2 stuff, though, it had always sort of been envisaged that other countries would, sort of plug in and be able to participate in that, other sort of trusted partners. So like Japan's a natural one. The Canadians and the New Zealanders have been sort of mentioned as well. Obviously, the latter two are sort of, you know, Five Eyes friends with Australia, the US and the UK. And so Japan's just going to sort of be limited to this pillar two and project by project. So there's things like hypersonics and space technology, which, you know, Japan have got some good strengths in. The Canadians, though, they need submarines.
Do they have a submarine fleet at the moment?
I'm not too sure what the current state of it is. They looked at getting nuclear-powered submarines in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
From either the British or the French. It sort of got knocked on the head at the time because of money.
Mm-hmm.
Also, too, the Americans, funnily enough, didn't like the idea of their near neighbour, despite their closeness, having nuclear-powered submarines. So it sort of just sort of withered and they went down the conventional path. But, you know, they've obviously got some security concerns in that part of the world, and you know, they're not getting on with China from time to time and as well. and things. So they're sort of looking about beefing up their military as well. So that would be an option down the track, perhaps.
Japan itself doesn't have nuclear submarine capabilities, do they? I mean, they've got conventional submarines. Do they? But they, I understand, don't want a nuclear capability. Is that it?
No, that's the case. And I mean, funnily enough, you know, sort of 10 years ago, we went very close to buying Japanese submarines for the Australian Navy. But they have conventional. They don't sort of need the range and endurance that nuclear power submarines offer. You know, given that their most of their focus is on sort of, you know, the East China Sea and things like that. They don't have to go too far afield. But they don't really want it, and it would probably. You know, given their sort of pacifist constitution with Japan, it would probably be just a step too far at this point going down that path. But, you know, certainly on the technology front, as some analysts have pointed out, you know, they're sort of right on the front line when it comes to sort of the Chinese missiles being in range of the Japan. So they've got some very good... tends to concentrate the mind on the need to have a sort of strong defence force in that case. And, they see AUKUS as a way to sort of build up those technologies and build alliances.
Okay. Well, what's been the reaction from China here? Presumably the Chinese are not keen on this development, which they would see as escalation, wouldn't they?
That's right. They put out their foreign ministry sort of commented on it yesterday before it was sort of made official. That Japan was going to be invited into these talks, and yeah, pretty standard sort of talks. Response from China, talking about escalation of the arms race in the region, critical of Australia, the US, and the UK for sort of trying to create blocks in the region and destabilise peace and security, and you know, a little warning to Japan not to sort of go down this path to reconsider. Things. Pretty predictable. And I mean, China from day one has been very anti-AUKUS, critical of it in public sort of statements and state-run media, and also sort of trying to thwart it behind the scenes too in UN agencies and things like that.
Is the US, how did all this come about, by the way? Is the US pushing this out, or where did it come from?
In terms of Japan's membership,
yes.
It is something I think very much driven by the US. The Australian view has sort of been: look, it's probably better to try and focus on getting nuclear submarines right before we start, bringing other partners in or expanding AUKUS or anything like that. Let's just sort of focus on core purposes. But I think the US is sort of keen to broaden and deepen alliances. You know, they have their two closest friends in the Asia Pacific are Australia and Japan. There's a natural fit there to be sharing on technology and things like that. You know, Japan's obviously got a high tech base as well. I think they're sort of keen to sort of push it. And given the uncertainty that we're seeing from America, you know, particularly if Donald Trump returns to the White House, this sort of netting of alliances, I think, is trying to Trump-proof it, perhaps.
Andrew Tillett's with us. He's Defence and Foreign Affairs reporter with the Australian Financial Review. Look, just off AUKUS or JAUKUS or caucus, however it's going, on defence matters, a senior Navy officer has been recommended to become the new chief of the Australian Defence Force. So there's a new commander of the Australian Defence Force. First time the Navy's got a look in for a while, actually. Vice Admiral David Johnson. He's currently the Vice Chief of Defence, but Mr Albanese, the Prime Minister, says he'll be appointed as the new overall commander, and his services span decades, he says.
Vice Admiral Johnson is a proven leader with the experience, intellect and resolve to lead the ADF in a complex and rapidly changing global strategic environment.
There you go. Well, the Vice Admiral himself recognised the importance and the complexities of his new position.
I am very conscious of the responsibility that comes with the role, the strategic environment in which we face ourselves, and most particularly the responsibility I have to the extraordinary men and women in the Australian Defence Force.
What's he like, Andrew? Good choice? What do we know about him? I mean, because to some degree this thing, they take turns, don't they, the Air Force, the Army and the Navy?
Well, it's been a long time, as you said, between turns for the Navy, 22 years. But I guess when we're spending billions on submarines and warships and, you know, the most immediate threat is in the maritime space, it makes sense to have a Navy person in the top job. Look, I think with Vice Admiral Johnson, David Johnson, he's a very decent person, very humble is how some people put it, very a good thinker. He's done work with the media in the past in terms of engagement and briefings and things like that. Been very experienced, been in sort of like senior command roles for the last 10 years in Russell, the Defence Department headquarters in Canberra. He's probably the most well-credentialed person we've had become a Chief of the Defence Force.
Okay.
So described, I think, very much as sort of the logical choice, experienced, safe pair of hands. But interestingly, he's only in the job for a couple of years.
That's right. He's only been given a two-year term. Any reason for that, do you think? Or they want it out?
Well, he's sort of in his early 60s, and not that we should be sort of ageist and things like that, but I don't think he's sort of keen for sort of the usual 4 or 5 years that sometimes these jobs can roll on to. As I said, he's sort of been in headquarters for 10 years already. He's done a lot of high tempo work, over that period we've had things like, Australian commitment to fighting ISIS, increasing patrols and exercises in the Southeast Asia and the Pacific and things like that. So there's been a lot on his plate to do, and some reforms in defence that this government is trying to impose, which David Johnson is, in the words of Richard Marles, is in the engine room of trying to bring into place, reforming defence acquisitions and culture and things like that.
Mm. You've been, last time we spoke, actually, Andrew, you'd broken a terrific story about the tensions between the minister's office. This is Richard Marles, the defence minister's office, and defence department bureaucrats of late, who both seem to have an equally low opinion of each other. How does this appointment reflect or improve or change or have bearing on these tensions?
Well, I think obviously he's obviously one who doesn't have tensions with the minister, otherwise he probably wouldn't have got the job. I think the minister's concerns, I think, have been not so much with the very top echelon of the defence force, but sort of the next rung down, where you tend to be more perhaps siloed, or, people have little individual fiefdoms they want to protect and things like that. So look, I think there'll be maybe perhaps an easing of some of those tensions. David Johnson's seen as sort of a very respected guy. He's a bit of a break from the current CDF, Angus Campbell, who, quite frankly, looks pretty worn out and has been a very sort of polarising figure. So there's a chance there for maybe a bit of a fresh start. He's very good. Got very good working relationships with both sides of politics, from what I understand. When Peter Dutton was the defence minister, he had a sort of a good relationship with David Johnston. So I think there'll be perhaps an easing of things, and the government will get a chance to put a stamp on it a bit when they release their national defence strategy next week, which is sort of like the last piece of their puzzle of their defence reform agenda.
Sure. All right, look, Andrew Tillett's with us from the Australian Financial Review. This is the Night Life News Breakdown. Speaking of changing roles in defence and security circles, the government's got a big opportunity here. You've written in the paper that the top jobs for ASIO, the Federal Police, the Signals Directorate, which used to be the DSD, and the Australian Border Force, all become vacant in coming months. It's quite a reshuffle about to happen. What are you hearing about this?
Yeah, it's sort of just coincidence, I think, rather than by design. But just terms of sort of coming up quickly. I think at this point, obviously they're squared away today, the head of the military. They've got some questions around what they do with the head of ASIO and the head of the AFP, first of all. They've sort of got to make decisions mid-year for, if they're replaced in September, if they extend them or things like that. I get the feeling that the two gentlemen currently doing the jobs, Mike Burgess at ASIO and Rhys Kershaw at AFP, probably wouldn't mind if their terms were extended slightly. Mm-hmm. I don't think they'd sign up for another sort of 5 years, perhaps, but, you know, maybe another two or 3 years. There's certainly an argument that people have put to me that, you know, we're living uncertain times and continuity is important. But at the same time, you know, you sort of have a chance to put your stamp on appointments and change culture. And this government, one thing this government has sort of been keen to do is to promote women into sort of senior leadership roles in the public service and intelligence services and things like that. So, I mean, that's another factor that could be at play. But, yeah, I don't know if it's a sort of – it wouldn't be fair to sort of characterise as a sort of a night of the long knives or a purge or anything like that. I mean, these are people who have been in their job for many years sort of thing, and there's a, you know, sort of a natural perhaps fatigue rate that comes in. But it's an intriguing time, and, you know, we'll no doubt see the bureaucratic Game of Thrones start to come into play.
I mean, Mike Burgess, the Director General of ASIO, of course, has taken a more prominent public role over recent times, hasn't he? He's been making public statements about the growing threat presented by foreign interference and so on. He made waves this year revealing an unnamed ex-politician had turned traitor to his country. Some in the community, security community might think this is revealing too much, although Home Affairs Minister Claire O'Neill says it's a deliberate border strategy to blow open the conversation about threats to Australia.
Director General Burgess has a much broader public role than a lot of previous DGs of security. That is intentional, and it is very important for our national security as a country and for that conversation that we're trying to have with people about what this means.
Is there are these permanent changes, do you think, Andrew?
Oh, as a journalist who covers security matters, I hope so. anytime we get the heads of agencies out there talking about what's going on, it's welcome. I hope they are in a genuine sense, because I think, you know, in this day and age of disinformation and misinformation, I think it's important that we hear from our agency heads talking about what risks they are and things like that, you know, having a more informed population. The proverbial working in the shadows might have worked in the past, but, you know, if people aren't there out talking about what's going on, you know, propagandists and others for countries that are not as friendly to Australia will fill that void happily, sort of thing. So I think it should be encouraged, and we should hear from more of our security chiefs sort of talking about it. And part of it's about getting their social license as well. You know, these agencies have an extraordinary powers of, you know, detention and intrusion into our private lives and stuff like that. And they need to be out there explaining, look, you know, this is what's going on and this is why things are happening.
Fair enough. Andrew, always great to talk. Appreciate it. Thank you.
No worries. Have a good night, Phil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.